Welcome to the Kona Edge, where you'll discover what the best triathletes in the world do to give them the edge.
Welcome onto this edition of the Kona Edge. I'm Brad Brown, and it's a pretty special edition of the Kona Edge today as well. I can't believe it. Episode 300. Yep, that's right. 300. Who would have thunk? We've been putting these things out pretty much every day. And 300. I love it. And didn't plan it this way, but today's interview is an absolute cracker. It is, I can safely say, and I've chatted to some incredible athletes over the time that we've been doing this podcast. And I say it quite often that that was my favorite one, or this one was my favorite one, but there's no doubt that today's interview is, so far, out of the 300 episodes of the Kona Eds I published, my favorite. And you're going to see why when we get into the story today. It is just so inspirational. If you don't believe that you can qualify and race on the Big Island in Kona after today's episode of the Kona Edge, I can't help you. I'm afraid there's nothing I can do to make you believe, but you're gonna know exactly what I'm talking about once you've listened to this story. Fantastic, fantastic story. Before we get into it, let me just tell you once again, if you haven't joined our private Facebook community, all you have to do is head over to thekonaedge.com/Facebook. Let me get that right. It's thekonaedge.com/Facebook. Get on there, come say hi, and hang out with some of the coolest triathletes on the planet. It's thekonaedge.com/Facebook. But without further ado, we head to Dublin in Ireland today to catch up with Rob Cummins. Welcome on to the Kona Edge. We head to Dublin in Ireland, and it's a great pleasure to touch base with Rob Cummins. Rob, welcome on to the Kona Edge. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Brad. Thanks for having me.
Rob, your life is all triathlon. You work in the industry. You obviously partake in the sport. It's a big part of your life, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I run a bike and triathlon store in Dublin with my wife, and the two of us run a small coaching business as well. And Aisling's an ultra runner by trade. She keeps me company on the triathlons, and I've been doing Ironman for about 9 years now.
Have you always been pretty sporty? Before triathlon, was there anything else, or was this your first sort of foray into it?
No, I was. I never did any sports as a kid, and smoked very heavily, and went off for a few years. Went off the rails a little bit for a few years, drinking and partying and getting into trouble. And I opened my first bike shop in 1998. And had been trying for a long time to get off the cigarettes. I smoked very heavily at the time. I was smoking probably 3 packs a day and was really unhealthy and was always sick. And about 6 months after I opened the store, I managed to get off cigarettes. And as an incentive to stay off, I suppose, or as a reward to myself for staying off, I bought a mountain bike and went out with a young lad that was working for me at the time. And he brought me out mountain biking. And for the first... we were going up a climb, and I had to stop every minute, every 2 minutes. I was getting off the bike and I was coughing up all sorts of muck from years of smoking. And about 3/4 way up, I just got sick of it. And I said, this is the stupidest thing I've ever done. I'm going home. And he said, come on, we'll go a little bit further and we'll go back down the single track. And we went up and we came back down the single track. And as soon as we turned down onto the trails, I really enjoyed it. I got a huge buzz, and we got to the bottom and I got him to bring me back up again. And I think at that stage, I started to get a little bit bitten by the bug. That was back in 99, but I was dreadfully unfit, and it took me years of going out and doing events and doing races and coming in last and all that sort of stuff before I discovered triathlon then in 2003. A South African guy actually was living here at the time, and I cycled with him for a couple of years, and he was into triathlon, and he brought me out and convinced me to do the Dublin City Triathlon in 2003. But I wouldn't have had a very auspicious start, I suppose. I was second last out of the water after doing the entire swim breaststroke. I couldn't really swim at the time. I was biking reasonably well. I'd done a little bit of bike racing, and I probably got off the bike inside the top 10 after getting out of the water in about 150th, I think, and then proceeded to be passed by everybody else on the run. So I might have finished 80th or 90th, but I loved the fact that even finishing just under 3 hours, that there was still crowds of people there to welcome you in, and there was a great sense of camaraderie, and I was absolutely hooked from that moment on. But I never had any ideas that I'd do anything other than do them just for fun, really, you know. I was semi-competitive in my head, but I had no illusions as to the fact that I'd ever be winning races or anything like that.
Rob, I love that. That is got to be one of the coolest stories that I've heard with regards to this podcast. And the reason I say that is because my background's very similar to that. Now, I also was a heavy smoker. I used to work in nightclubs. I was a DJ for many, many years and just lived it up. And I love the fact that you like me, if that makes sense. Not that I'm a great athlete, but you've got a background. And I think that's the cool thing about the show is we get to chat to so many different people, and it doesn't matter what your background is. We all get into the sport on different paths, and it's what we make of the opportunity that's in front of us right now that dictates where we go in the future.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's fantastic. Rob, when did you realize you had a little bit of ability? I mean, that first triathlon on the bike, you sound like an absolute monster on the bike, but when did you realize you were actually pretty good at this thing?
I'd done probably another... It was 2008 before I did an Ironman. I'd seen Ironman Hawaii on TV back when I was a smoker, way before I ever got involved in the sport. And I just thought it was the most incredible thing. And I suppose it was always in the back of my head that when I saw it and I was sitting there as a smoker, I sort of thought, I'll do that someday. Not having any idea really what that meant, you know, not just to complete an Ironman, but to do Hawaii, you know. And in 2008, I eventually plucked up the courage to do Ironman France. So I trained quite hard. Well, for the level that I was at then, I trained quite hard and I went out. And to be honest, I was more afraid of not finishing than anything else. I didn't know if I could do the distance, and that was the biggest fear for me in France. So I got through it okay and had an incredible experience and finished, from memory, somewhere around 1,200th place out of maybe 1,500 athletes. So I was very much back at the field. And I think what changed for me that year was I discovered an absolute love of being an athlete, albeit a very slow one. I love the lifestyle. I love the training and the discipline and all of that went with going from being somebody who trained, you know, two or three times a week, you know, one swim, one bike, one run, to somebody who had this regular six or seven training sessions a week and started to live the life of an athlete at a very small level. I really loved that and I enjoyed it. And I think that was where my real love affair with Ironman started. I had a tough year personally that year. I separated from my wife. I think a lot of people call it an Ironman divorce. So the Ironman thing probably contributed, but I think it had been on the cards for a long time. And not long after, I met and got together with the lady that I'm married to now, Aisling, and we've been together since then. But she's an athlete, and I think living with an athlete and falling in love with that lifestyle, it made becoming an athlete much easier. So in 2009, the following year, I decided I'd have a go at Ironman Switzerland. And I guess I always had this idea in the back of my head that because I wasn't a million miles off each individual sport, you know, if I went out and swam as hard as I could for 3.8K, I was maybe 10 or 15 minutes off what I needed to be doing for a Kona slot. And if I went out and biked hard for 180K, I was, you know, I was close to the other guys on the bike. And the run, I wasn't great, but I was still only 20 or 30 minutes off. Now, that being said, that's if I went out and did each of those individually, absolutely flat out. And, you know, I was sort of kidding myself and saying, you know, if you just added those together, you probably wouldn't slow down too much. So I went and I trained really hard for Switzerland. And I didn't say anything to anybody that I'd sort of got this idea that I'd like to do a fast one and see how close I could get to Kona. But I went and I trained really hard and I did the race and I moved up a grand total of about 200 places. I just barely broke the top 1,000. And I think for a long time after that, I sort of decided that that was the level of athlete that I was, that I was never going to improve much more above that. We opened a big new business in 2010, and in 2011 our life had sort of settled down a little bit after the craziness of the first year of the business. And I said it to Aisling, and she'd coached people for a few years and she'd been involved at sport at an elite level. She's a number of Irish bests, and she's a mountain runner and an ultra runner, and she raced at a very high level. But she, you know, there's no messing with her. There's no BS. So I asked her, what did she think about the idea of, could I possibly try and chase a Kona slot? And did she think it was a realistic thing? And her immediate reaction was yes. And I was a bit surprised, to be honest, but I you know, immediately grasped onto that and I thought, okay, well, if Ash believes it's possible, then, you know, I'll take that and we'll have a go at it. So we didn't really know what to do next. So she suggested that we contact a coach that we both knew, an ex-pro athlete who was coaching people. And we reckoned he was a pretty good coach. And we contacted him a week or 2 weeks later and asked him, what did he think about chasing a Kona slot? And he sort of looked at me and said, yeah, no, I don't think so. That's not going to happen, you know. Maybe if you spent the next 2 years of your life training like crazy, you could, but realistically, no, you're not a Kona athlete. And in fairness, he was only looking at what he'd seen me do before, you know. So I was a little bit disappointed and quite gutted when we were chatting to him. And I sort of came back to him a couple of minutes later and I said, well, do you know how to coach somebody to get them to Kona? And he said, yeah, of course I do. And I says, okay, well, give me that program then. Just coach me, like, doesn't matter what you believe or don't believe. Give me the program. If you break me or injure me or if I don't do it, it's not your fault. I'll take responsibility for whatever happens or doesn't happen. And I think he was pretty skeptical, but he agreed. And that was 2011. That would have been about March, late March 2011. And up to then, I'd sort of been training probably 6 to 8, maybe 9 hours a week. 10 hours would have been a big week, but on average, 6 to 8 hours a week. And in the first 8 days with the new coach, I think I hit about 30 hours. And on the last day of the first week, I did a race, a sprint race, with about 28 or 29 hours training in my legs already that week, which was, it was a whole month's training for me up to that point. I'd never done anything like that before. I was just gobsmacked that I could even manage 30 hours training. And I did a race, a sprint race, and I came third. And I'd never been third in any race in my life. And this is at the back end of a massive week of training. And I won my age group. So it was a real light bulb moment going off for me. You know, I realized that, you know, getting fast has, as much as I hate to say it, being the person who sells you the nice bike, it has very little to do with the equipment. It has very little to do with all the fluff and rubbish you read in the magazines. You just do an awful lot of training and 90% of the improvement comes from that. So over the next couple of months, we'd picked Ironman Florida as being the target. And Peter, the coach, said, listen, Florida's not going to suit you. It's flat. It's a big power rider's course. I'm relatively small. I'm light. I'm about 67, 68 kilos. And he said, you need a course that's hilly and hard. He says, you do well on the hills. So we picked Ironman UK. The only problem with that was it was on we had less than 5 months. So I was looking at going from sort of back of the pack to trying to qualify from Kona in less than 5 months. And the only way that Peter could do it was, I think, to literally just give me the biggest volume that I could handle. And he sort of kept me on this red line of absolutely on the limit of what I could cope with. And very often I just went over it. Like, I'd have weeks of 25 and 27 and 28 hours training. And I had a couple of training camps where we hit 40 plus hours in a week. And I'd be floored for 10 days afterwards and hardly able to get out of bed. And I raced a few times in the lead up to UK and they went dreadfully. you know, I'd be out on the bike in training, and I'd be doing 40K time trials in 57, 58 minutes, and then I'd go out and race, and I'd be doing them in an hour 15, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. But it was obviously just the huge levels of fatigue where just the body was just up and down. So I rocked up to Ironman UK after about 5 months, and I finished, I think including the pros, I finished 36. And including out of the age groupers, I was 26th, and I was, I think, 7th in my age group. And I missed a Kona slot by 2 minutes. So, to be honest, missing the Kona slot wasn't the big disappointment that I thought it would be, because all of a sudden I felt like a Kona athlete. I knew I could do it. The fact that it was 2 minutes was negligible. I'd gone much faster than any of the Kona slots had been gotten in the year before. It was just a fast year. Everybody went quick. I broke 10 hours on a very hard course, and I had a, you know, it was a big pivot for me in terms of I now felt like a fast athlete. I felt like a Kona person. So we raced Florida, and again I came quite close a couple of months later. And in 2012 then, with as it's funny, as the coach had said, you need 2 years. He wasn't far off. With about 18 months training in me, I went out and I qualified the following year again in UK. The conditions and the course tend to suit me, and I qualified there on a roll down the first time. And again in 13, I went back and I qualified a straight qualification the third time.
That's I'm sitting here grinning. I have to tell you, Rob, because that's amazing. And I think a lot of people look, like you say, the flashy fast bikes and the gadgets and the tools, but it's 90% hard work. And I think the other 10% is all in the head. It's you need to believe that you can do it.
Yeah, and even with the belief was something in the first year that, to be honest, I never believed it for a minute, Brad. I didn't feel it. You know, from the start, Aisling said to me, yeah, we're going to do this, and yeah, I think you can do it. But everybody else was looking at me going, you're off your head. You're crazy. You know, they mightn't have said it quite in those terms, but I could see it, you know. And actually, one of the things that I don't think I'd mentioned was, as part of the trying to get to Kona, I came up with this idea that we'd try and tie it into marketing with the shop as well. So I knew a friend who was an editor for one of the big outdoor sports magazines in Ireland, and I approached her with the idea that I'd write a series in the magazine following the progress from back of the pack to see if I could do it. And she sort of, I thought she'd laugh at me when I said it, but she thought it was a great idea. I think she was sort of thinking, there's no way you're going to do it, but it'll, you know, people will be interested. So I had this series of articles in a national magazine going, following me. So there was always this huge sense of pressure to try and do it. So it wasn't like I just told three people and we worked on it quietly among ourselves. I had a blog and we had a big mailing list in the shop, and it was going out to 15,000 people a week on that. And then it was going out in the national magazine every 6 weeks. So there was quite a big following, you know, in a very, very small sense, you know, in a very small sport. It was reasonably well known. So lots of people would be coming into the shop and asking how things were going. But I could see people were all very skeptical about it. Like I said, I'd never done anything that would make anybody else think that it was possible. And as a result, I think I never really believed it. And to be honest, the moment that I sort of realized that it was actually happening was, I got out of the swim and I raced that day without a watch because I didn't want to get out of the swim 3 or 4 minutes or 5 minutes or any amount of time slower than I'd hoped to do and have that affect my head for the day. So I did the swim, got out, got onto the bike, and I wouldn't be a great swimmer, but I started biking through, and as I got through the field, it started to thin out and I was passing less and less people, but I'd no idea where I was. You know yourself, you're in an Ironman, you could be in 1,000th place, you could be in 150th. You have no idea. The people change slightly as you get further towards the front of the field, but you still have no idea. You could be 100th, you could be 50th, you could be 300th. You know, they all look fast. They're all on tri bikes. They've all got aero helmets. And near the end of the bike, I came around the corner and there was a female athlete. I think it might have been Desiree Flicker at the time, or maybe that's not her name. Anyway, she was an American athlete, and she'd been in the media during the week as being the favorite for the women's race. And I came around the corner and passed her. And all of a sudden, I realized, you're right up at the pointy end of the field. You're actually doing what you've been dreaming about and talking about for the last 5 months. It's actually happening. And that was the first time that it became real for me and that I really believed it. And about 6 or 7K later, I rolled into transition and it was empty. And that had never happened to me before. Like, normally I roll into transition and there's 1,000 bikes in it. I got into transition and there was about 50 bikes in it. And the place was empty. And it was just, all of a sudden, it all became very, very real for me. And I realized, you're actually doing what you set out to do. And I think it's important for people to know that you don't need to believe in something in the beginning to make it happen. You don't need to believe that it's possible for you to get to Kona or to do something that you think is impossible for you. You just need to start taking steps and get somebody who knows what they're doing to teach you. And for me, that's all it was. I had Aisling with the belief. I had a coach in Peter who knew how to get me there. And I was just willing to do the work. I had a huge drive. And then I put a gun to my head by sticking it in a national magazine so that if I failed, I was going to look like a real clown.
Rob, I think that is unbelievable advice because... And even if you don't want to qualify for Kona, you mentioned your first Ironman, or with one of them, you thought, I would like to do that, but I don't know if I could finish those distances. And that, I think, for everyone who's training for their first Ironman is probably the biggest concern, is will I be able to finish this thing? And like you say, you don't believe it when you first start. You probably don't believe it until you've done it. But you just got to start. That's what it boils down to. And so few people in life, it doesn't matter what sphere you're in, don't start. They think something will be cool, but they just don't do it.
Yeah, absolutely. No, the starting is the most important thing. Just taking action. Like, I had had it in my head for a couple of months before I spoke to Aisling about it. So I started training a little bit, and I was reading stuff online. And you know yourself, you go onto Google and you ask Google a question and 4 million answers come back. So I had people saying they'd qualified for Kona on 6 hours training a week, and I had other people saying you needed to qualify 30 hours a week. And I didn't really know what the hell I was doing, but I'd started. And even the fact that I was doing the wrong thing, I at least had 2 months of very basic training before I started with the coach, so it wasn't coming from 2 months of inactivity. Like, because we're both involved in the sport, we're always doing something, so there's always a level of, in the off season we run every day or whatever, so I would have been relatively fit, but I wasn't in Ironman shape or anything like it. You know, it was a couple of years since I'd done one. We'd had a really crazy year with the shop, but you just need to start. You take a step, and if you need to change direction, it's easy to change direction when you're moving. But if you don't start, you don't know if you're doing the right thing or the wrong thing, and you're never going to get there.
If you could go back and do this whole journey over again around the training, is there anything you would change? Is there anything you would do differently?
No, I don't think so. And that's not to say that I did everything right. I didn't. I made lots of mistakes. But I think I've probably learned an awful lot from the mistakes that make me I'd like to think it makes me a much better athlete now. And it helps a lot with the coaching because I'm better able to teach people. I can see things coming that are going to cause problems a little bit further down the road for me and for other people, because I suppose I've made so many mistakes over the years. I don't think I'd change an awful lot of it. I really like the journey. Like I said, not getting that Kona slot the first time was difficult because I didn't get it and I came so close, but it wasn't difficult because I came so close. It meant that I the biggest part of the journey was done for me. I knew it was just a case of, okay, you rock up next year and you do the same again with a year's more fitness. You're going to do it. So at that stage, I believed in it completely, 100%. So getting to that stage was enough that day. Like there's stupid things I've done in training. I had a session with that coach not long after Ironman UK, and I came out of Ironman UK with such a huge level of confidence and belief that I started to do things that I wasn't supposed to do in training. So we had a couple of weeks easy, and about a month after UK, I started to get really, really good form. Like I'd never felt anything like it. And the coach had me down for a 5-hour bike ride with some interval work in it. And I think a 10K run off it. And he had me down for 3 by 1 hour at Ironman race pace. So I went out and very quickly the average speed was quite high. And I sort of thought, maybe I'll just keep going a little bit more than the hour and see how long can I hang on to this. And at about an hour and a half, I was sitting at 36, 37K an hour average. And I kept on going and I didn't recover in between the intervals and I just kept on going. And I got to 5 hours and I sort of thought, let's keep going. We'll aim for 190 or 200K. And I went through 180K in about 503 or 504, which I think is about 36K an hour average, which for me would be crazy fast in training. You know, it's a race day bike split for me. I'd be comfortable. I'd be around, you know, low fives or thereabouts. And here I am doing this in training against the coach's orders just because I felt great. And I had this incredible bike ride. I think I did close to 200K at about 36K an hour. Got into the house and the run was to be an easy 10K run off it. And where we were living at the time, as we came out of the house, it was downhill onto the run loop that I was going to do. And I went through the first kilometer in about 4 minutes. And again, I'm looking at the numbers thinking, Jesus, this is incredible. So I thought, let's see how long you can hang on to 4 minute Ks for, which again, I know you talk to people like, I was listening to Martin Muldoon's interview the other day, and Martin's got this huge run pedigree. You know, 4 minute Ks for Martin are slow, but 4 minute Ks off a bike ride for me is, you know, it's nearly what I'd be doing a 10K in standalone. I'm not a fast runner. I just don't tend to slow down a huge amount off the bike, but I went through the 10K in about 40 minutes and I thought I was Superman. You know, I've done this 200K bike and a 10K run in a time that I couldn't do in a race 6 weeks before, and I thought, I'm going to cram in another 5 or 6 days of training after this because I had a few days off work and I couldn't get out of bed the next morning. And I dragged myself up and I got on the bike and I lasted about an hour and I went back home and I got into bed and I slept for most of the day. And it took me about 5 or 6 weeks, I'd say, to recover from that. Now, the thing about that was both the coach and Aisling had been saying to me in the previous week that they were obviously looking at signs that I was starting to come to a peak, but that I was also getting very tired. I was on that red line of getting close to overtraining. And I wouldn't listen to them because I felt so good in training. I was setting PBs every time I got in the pool and I was going faster on the bike. And I thought I knew best. So I disregarded what the coach and what Aisling were saying. And I went out and I did the bike ride much harder. I did the run much harder. And that tipped me over the edge. And it took me about 6 weeks to recover from that. And I was in training for another Ironman. We were going straight into Ironman Florida. And it meant that I didn't get a Kona slot in Florida either. So it was a really good lesson to learn that when things look like they're at their best, very often that's when you need to be really careful in training. That's the time that you're going to be most tempted to push and push and push to try and get that extra tiny little bit. And conversely, in the run-up to the UK, when I was doing races and expecting to be top 10 or 15 and I was coming in 90th, when things are at their worst, it's just because your training load maybe is very high or that you're tired and you can't always just look at something and go, okay, well, 6 weeks before Ironman UK, I can't even break the top 10 in a small local race. I'm 90th. So the idea of trying to qualify for Kona is ridiculous. It wasn't. It was just part of the training. There was no taper. There was, you know, so things don't always, it doesn't always equal what you see. So if you feel great, the obvious answer might be, okay, well, keep on training while you're feeling great. While it's really, sometimes you should just back off and bank that and allow the body absorb it and then go again. And for me, that was the biggest lesson that year, was to not keep on pushing when things seem to be going well.
Rob, looking at going into that first Kona, I mean, your belief, as you mentioned, was sky high. I mean, coming from someone who was the real back of the packer to bagging a Kona slot, you must have felt going into that first one that you could walk on water. How do you approach a race like Kona, knowing that the level of competition is taking not just one more step up, but this is huge, and you going into this thing, how did you approach it?
Oh, I to be honest, when I, it was when I qualified for Kona, there was the realization actually hit me that I had to do another Ironman. Because I think you're so focused on the act of qualifying, you don't realize that actually I've now got to go and do a race that's much harder and much more competitive. And that penny dropped for me the day I got the Kona slot. It's like, God, I've got to go and train for a race now, and it's a much harder one. And when I got to Kona, I felt like a complete imposter. I spent, you know, the week walking around waiting for somebody to tap me on the shoulder and say, actually, you're not really meant to be here. This is for fast people. I don't know how you got a slot. And I went into it really just wanting to have the experience of being there. You know, we did the underpants run. We did everything. I broke all the rules that you'd have going into any race. I spent the whole week on my feet. You know, we were in the expo every day. Every time there was a pro talk or something on, we went to it and we met, you know, Mark Allen and Dave Scott, and we were down at the coffee boat swim every day. And we went very much for the experience the first year, and the race was going to be a bonus. And I had no illusions as to where I stood in the pecking order on that day. I didn't really expect to be in any way competitive. That being said, I was in good shape going into it, probably in the best shape of my life. So there was a part of me thinking, you'll have a good race. You're not going to be competitive with the people you're racing with, but you can have a good day for yourself. But oh, it's such a hard race. I had a real, the race really took me down a peg or two. I think it sort of put manners on me. The swim was hard and slow. I went through the first 90K of the bike too hard and really blew up, the worst blow up I'd had in any race at that stage. I think I was 2.5 hours to the halfway point and 3:15 for the second half. So I really blew up, and I had 20-year-old girls biking past me on the bike, where I'm normally catching the female pros and even catching some of the male pros on the bike. And it was a real eye opener. I'd never seen so many strong people in my life. And I got onto the run and I was hanging from very early on. I got through about 10 miles okay. I got into town, got up Palani Hill and ran up Palani Hill, and I'm looking at all these people who are walking or shuffling up Palani Hill, and I thought, ugh, I don't walk up hills, I don't jog up hills, you know. And I ran up hard, and I got onto the Queen K, and within about 30 seconds I was walking. I could see afterwards, looking back, why everybody slows down so much on Palani, because your temperature just rises, and that was it was game over for me. So I had the long journey out Queen K and back in. Was jog, walk, shuffle, a little bit of puking, and trying to just enjoy the experience as much as I could, as I could, while I was getting passed by everybody else. But the first experience was very humbling. I think the field that you're racing against is just unbelievable. You know, even just being on the island, you've got 10,000 of the fittest people you've ever seen. It's like landing on a different planet. It's unlike anything I'd ever experienced.
And going back to some time, did you manage to put some of those demons to bed from their first experience?
It got a little bit better. I was in really good shape. Aisling was coaching me by the time I went back the second time. And again, at that stage, I probably had close to 4 years training. So I'm a big believer in the accumulative effect of just being consistent and after 3 or 4 years of consistent strong training, I was in reasonably good shape going out, and I took about 10 or 11 minutes off the swim. I think I was about 107 or 108 for the swim versus nearly 119 the previous year. I had a decent enough bike. I was just over 5 hours. In fairness, it wasn't the hardest bike conditions that year. It was really hot, but the wind wasn't as crazy as the previous year. I got off the bike and had a reasonable run, and managed to get all the way to the, coming out of the energy lab, I passed Kenny Glass, and I got a bit giddy, I think, at passing somebody like Kenny Glass, who's been out there, I think, 29 or 30 times, and probably went a little bit too hard on the climb up out of the energy lab. But I was obviously on right on the red line already and blew up and had another little puke at the top of the energy lab and shuffled in. It was certainly better than the previous year, but Kona's the hardest race I've ever been at to execute. Not just that it's hard conditions, it's really, really hard to execute right. The heat is just, it's so extreme, the heat and the humidity, and once you lose control of it, if you allow yourself to overheat, there really isn't any coming back from it. You can't cool down. You know, you've seen pictures of the race leaders sticking their heads into the big drums of ice water, and you just can't recover. You can't cool down once you overheat there. So it's I think it's the guys who are good at controlling themselves and not getting excited and doing stupid things like racing somebody who doesn't know you exist. And not pushing too hard at any stage, you know. But the second one was better. But I think there's still work to do. I could see myself improving if I can figure out the conditions a bit better.
Obviously, training in Dublin is slightly different to the racing conditions in Kona. Climate's vastly different.
Oh yeah, and certainly the time of year it's completely different. So it's we have a sort of a gym set up in the house here with the bikes and the treadmill, and we have a heater in there to try and replicate being warm, but I don't think we can get the temperature more than 26 or 27 degrees versus the 40 degrees you'd have in Kona, and obviously you don't have the humidity, so it's almost impossible to replicate it. But that being said, Ireland doesn't tend to send out an awful lot of athletes each year. We'll have anything from 5 or 6 to 12 or 15, but there's 7 or 8 of the guys that go out there are really competitive. You've got the likes of Ivan O'Gorman, who runs a 252 or 253 marathon in Kona. There's Martin Muldoon and Owen Martin. I don't know if you've certainly talked to Martin Muldoon. I don't know if you've met Owen Martin, but they'd be fast runners out there as well. So it can be done. The pale paddies can figure out how to run in the heat. Alan Ryan, a good friend of mine, has been on the podium twice in Kona, and again he's living in Ireland and he's figured out how to do it. So I've no doubt we can do it. It's just a matter of figuring out how to train properly for it.
Have you've obviously got unfinished business on that island. You going back, aren't you?
Yeah. After 2013, I'd had a back injury early 2013. So when I went out to Kona, I was carrying a bit of a back injury, and that got really bad when I came back afterwards. And I had spinal surgery in January or February 2014. So I was about 18 months out of the sport, and came back and did a couple of Ironmans. Really, as it turns out, just for fun. I wasn't in great shape in 2015. I did two of them quite close together. I did Ironman UK in Maastricht, and they went okay, but I was quite a bit off where I would have been a few years ago. So I decided in 2016 I was going to try and qualify again, and again I decided I'd do it as part of a sort of a marketing thing for the shop. So I kept a blog all year of my training and racing, and figured that if I'd done it before in gotten very close in 5 or 6 months, if I gave myself 8 or 9 months last year, I'd get there. So we entered Ironman Mallorca, and I think I probably would have been able to qualify had everything gone well all year, and then I had a good race day. But I had a lot of difficulties during the year that I hadn't really anticipated. Just normal life stuff that I think, if I had 18 months training done, you'd manage to juggle difficulties like work, and I got sick a couple of times. But when I was trying to compress everything into a really short time frame, it was too much to ask. So I raced in Mallorca and didn't qualify. But I'm sort of, I was close enough that I could see it'll happen this year. So I think we're going to go back to Florida this year. And race there and chase a slot for next year.
Awesome. Well, Rob, if people want to get in touch with you, I know you've got the coaching and you've got the shop as well. How can they reach out to you? And I'll put the links to the blog as well on the show notes. But tell us a little bit about the business itself.
The business is Wheelworks Bike and Tri Shop in Dublin and Ireland. We tend to deal mostly for the local Irish market. We don't really do mail order or internet stuff. And the coaching is tricoach.ie. And we tend to keep that quite small. We don't take on a whole lot of athletes. That's more a passion thing for us. It's something we're very passionate about. Myself and Aisling both really enjoy the coaching, and we get a huge kick out of seeing athletes do well. So we keep the number small, and we tend to have quite good personal relationships with everybody we coach.
Brilliant. I'll pop those links in. If people want to check it out, they're more than welcome to. Thank you so much for your time today. I look forward to catching up and chatting about the other disciplines. But we'll save that for another time. Thanks for your time today, Rob.
Thanks, Brad. Thanks for having me.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Kona Edge. Don't forget to connect with us on social media. Simply search for the Kona Edge.